This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. FBI agent Christopher Whitcomb was in his boss's office delivering his letter of resignation when he saw the World Trade Center attack on TV. We talked to him about that the day after the attack. We invited him back to share some of his experiences from his 15 years with the FBI, six of which were spent as a sniper on the hostage rescue team. He also directed information management for the Critical Incident Response Group, which responds to terrorist attacks. In Whitcomb's new memoir, Cold Zero, Inside the FBI Hostage Rescue Team, he describes working on the team as a game for thinkers.
I think what people don't understand about tactical work involved in these things, and by tactical work I mean the possibility that you'd actually have to run in and resolve something with violence. We try to stay away from that in the United States now. We do everything possible to prevent that, but the bottom line is sometimes that's the only option, it's the only way out. And the provision to handle this sort of an eventuality is the hostage rescue team. The FBI put this group together in 1983, and it's really become the United States' asset in a terrorist attack. What they strive to find in people is decision makers, because they always say you can teach anyone to shoot, you can teach anyone to run and jump and be a reasonable athlete, but what is difficult to find is people that can run into a room, differentiate between threats and the hostages, and make instant life or death decisions that are going to have a dramatic impact for many, many years down the line. That's what I mean when they try to find decision makers, people that are smart enough to know when not to shoot.
Now, how much discretion did you have as a sniper with the Hostage Rescue Team?
Ultimately, you have all the discretion. You know, we've had these well-publicized rules of engagement changes at Ruby Ridge, and even talked about it at Waco in some of these terribly controversial events. But bottom line is each person that lies behind a rifle, each person that takes a handgun when they join the FBI, accepts the personal responsibility that what they do with that weapon is falls on their own shoulders. And each of them know that. I mean, these are not uneducated people. These are bright decision makers who've had some accomplishment in other careers before they come to the FBI. So you give them this kind of a responsibility, this sense of life and death responsibility, and you expect that they're going to make the decision they have to make, you know, on their own.
Just run through for us some of the situations that you were called in for.
Well, from the first hour, I think, the first 2 hours that I joined the FBI, I went out on a bank robbery, which turned bad. The bank robber that we found in this house came out of the house with a .357 caliber handgun, waved it and said he was going to kill the two people standing at the door. So everybody dove out of their cars and grabbed shotguns and ran for cover and everything else. And I thought, sitting in the back of this car, that my goodness, you know, I was an hour on the job and all of a sudden all hell was breaking loose. And I heard a voice yelling my name, and it was actually my boss of 2 hours, yelling at me to hide behind the car and put my gun back in my holster because he didn't want me to hurt anybody. So I think, you think these scenes are going to play out just like they do in some television show or some movie, and they're never, never the way they seem. But it went from there to, you know, many, many different types of confrontations in the bank robberies and things that I worked, the fugitive investigations that I worked in my first office. And then back at HRT, everything from the Los Angeles riots to Ruby Ridge and Waco and many, many events.
In similar situations you were in, like Waco, you were, in Waco, for days and days and days, you were just sitting behind your gun waiting.
You know, that's what it always is, Terry. I wrote something in my book about it's a lonely profession marked by boredom and rare moments of thrill or something like that, because that's really what it boils down to, that many times a hostage rescue team sniper is sent out to do a job, but almost all of that time is spent doing surveillance, that you sit through and look through a scope, usually a rifle scope because you don't want to carry too much gear, but usually looking through a scope and providing information. It's very monotonous, very methodical. You read information, trying to establish patterns of behavior and things like that. But sometimes, from time to time, you know, things happen very, very quickly and they don't go the way that you think they will.
How does the world look different through a scope of a gun than it does if you're just using your eyes?
Well, I mean, literally and metaphorically, it's a tunnel. I mean, you're looking through a very narrowly defined world through this tube that we call a rifle scope, and you can't see what's outside it. So sometimes you have to find yourself sort of trying to maintain contact outside that. You get very, very focused on the job, very, very wrapped around that particular event. And sometimes you have to step back and gain the perspective to put everything in context. And I think we saw that very clearly the first time. I know I saw it the first time in my life at Ruby Ridge, Idaho. And you know, that's been widely talked about for years and years and will be for many, many more years. But that was a perfect example.
How?
Well, I remember walking up on this mountain. We'd been up for 36 hours straight under fairly difficult circumstances with the flight time and the mount outs and everything like that. We end up in this freezing weather with a low cloud cover and a drizzling rain, freezing, just shivering, and it was in the low, the air was in the low 30s, as I recall. And we walk up on this mountainside really having no idea what we were going to find, except that we'd been told that these people inside the cabin had engaged in a shootout with these marshals. And it was one of my first missions as a sniper on the hostage rescue team. I lie down behind my rifle from this rocking ledge up above the cabin, and within minutes of lying down after walking, 2 hours walking up there, all of a sudden these people come running out of the cabin right at me with weapons. It was not something I expected. It wasn't something I'd even really thought much about, and there it was playing out in front of me. And then I hear gunfire, and things spin very, very quickly after that. Many times you go up there, you look through the rifle scope, you know your job, but it ultimately comes down to a life or death decision in the blink of an eye, in a split second. And it's very difficult to put that in perspective sometimes if you don't have the experience.
Did you have to shoot at Ruby Ridge?
No, but I've said this often, that I made the same decision that Lon Horiuchi made, and that I was trying to shoot at Ruby Ridge, but because of my angle, the people were moving, Kevin Harris, Randy Weaver, and the woman that we eventually found out was his daughter were moving from building to building, from rock to rock, from tree to tree, and there was no opportunity to shoot.
Now, in Waco, it was, I think, over 50 days that you were behind your rifle.
Right, 52 days.
Waiting it out. How do you keep your focus?
Well, it's really hard to keep your focus. I mean, literally, it's very difficult to look through a scope for that length of time because it gives you a colossal headache. And you even sometimes get vertigo or lose your balance because you just, because that is your entire world. It's a magnified scope, and you're focusing on a small object, maybe a window pane, maybe a door lock, trying to gather information about how that door might open, about how the window might open, who you see in the window, all of those things. So literally, it's very, very difficult. And figuratively, it is also, because once again, you get consumed with that world, and it's tough to maintain that focus and stay interested for any length of time. So the way to overcome that is to try to limit the shifts for an hour or maybe 2 hours on the scope, and then to rotate your personnel through. So you may have 5 or 6 or 8 people in a position, but each of them would only actually be on the scope for an hour, maybe 2 hours at a time.
So everybody has an assignment, like your assignment might be the door or the lock on the door, something really small.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in the days leading up to that final, to April 19th, the day of the fire, each of the snipers would go on, and you would really do a sort of a general assessment when your shift began. And you would look around, and you'd see how the place had changed, what faces you saw at the windows, because you get to know these people after a time. David Koresh had sentries that would come to the windows, and they'd wave when they came on their shifts. They were doing exactly the same thing we were, and we got to know each other over the course of 2 months. So you'd come on, and you'd sort of check things out, see if anything had changed, make sure that they hadn't cut any new holes for firing ports in the side of the building, things like that. But then after a time, you focus on individual things that you might find change or something specific. But on that last day, when we all knew the gas insertion was going to begin, each of us was on a rifle, each of us was on a scope, and each of us had a very narrowly defined area that we were watching.
Did you ever shoot during the whole siege of Waco?
No, and I think that's something that most people don't understand, that no one, not one of us, fired a single round the entire time we were at Waco. I think that's never been really stated, although, most of us believe that the American public takes it for granted, and I think they don't. What they don't understand is that last day, Koresh and his people fired hundreds, if not thousands, of rounds at us throughout the morning, from 6 a.m. when the gas insertion started, right up until the time of the fire. And no one ever fired back from anyone in law enforcement, including I should point out that at one point I walked out of the building from behind my scope with a camera to walk around the side, and someone, as the fire grew and as the flames grew and the smoke swelled around them, someone, as one of their last dying acts on Earth, tried to shoot me, and I was standing next to a teammate when the round went right between our heads, missing us just by no more than a foot. So, you know, I think to take, to come that close to getting shot in the head and quite obviously dying, to have restraint and not to shoot in a situation like that, I think is a testament to the control that we had there. And I think very few people understand that, really.
Why didn't you shoot?
Our rule stated, and basic FBI policy states, that you can't shoot someone unless you know specifically who they are and that you specifically know them to be a threat. And at that time, all of Koresh's snipers, all of Koresh's people, had built what we call hides, which are really positions inside windows and doors so that you can't see them. You can look out through them with a scope, but you can't see in. So if they, not if, when they fired out of those positions, we could see maybe muzzle flash, we might see a barrel or a barrel jump, but we couldn't see the target behind it. And many, many times at Waco, we had seen people come to the doors and to the windows to look out at us and hold small children up in front of them. And no one was going to fire into that building knowing that these people had held up children in front of them. So even though they were shooting at us, we were covered behind sandbags and secure positions. And even though they were shooting at us, they didn't present a threat. So we had no reason to shoot back at them.
What went through your mind when, after 52 days of waiting it out, the whole compound went up in flames and everybody inside was burned to death?
Well, you know, I went through a great number of emotions in a short period of time. First was shock. I mean, I'd laid in this position for 52 days, as you were saying, waiting for something to happen. And we never knew from day to day, Terry, what was going to happen. And I thought that was one of the great shortcomings of this entire mess, really, is that none of us on the ground there knew from day to day when we were going to resolve it, how we were going to resolve it, what was going to happen. And then the night before, on April 18th, we were told to come in for a double shift, which told us something was going to happen, but we didn't know what. They came out and briefed us late that night, and then the next morning, we got up early, about 4 o'clock, I think, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and actually got ready to prepare for the gas insertion. So no one knew what was going on, and then we sat there all morning while the construction vehicles put gas into the building, and then all of a sudden, we were looking at the building around noon, and we saw smoke. And thought, you know, what could that be? What, you know, what is, the smoke was coming out the door, and thought that was impossible. So you go through boredom, you go through surprise, you go through shock, and then it became an overwhelming sense of anger that I still remember very clearly, because I realized they were killing themselves. I realized that, you know, we'd been there all this time, and I felt absolutely helpless to do anything about it, and I realized that they were committing suicide, and it was a devastating thing.
Christopher Whitcomb is my guest. He's a former FBI special agent, author of the new memoir, Cold Zero, Inside the FBI Hostage Rescue Team. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is recently retired FBI agent Christopher Whitcomb. He's written a memoir called Cold Zero, Inside the FBI Hostage Rescue Team. You were the director of the Crisis Response Wing of the FBI's Critical Incident Response Group, and you had to establish an Emergency Information Management Cell. You describe emergency information as a new field being developed by the military to identify and predict the effects of critical incidents on large groups of people. What does that mean?
Well, what it boils down to is the FBI and the federal government can approach a crisis from every conceivable angle now. We have the tactical wing, like the hostage rescue team. We have negotiators. We have behavioral assessment professionals, or profilers, as they're better known. We have logistics units. We show up at a crisis with the experience and the resources, really, to handle about everything you can imagine. What we'd never really looked at as an organization or as a government is how to deal with things like panic, as we talked about before, and things like sympathetic casualties. We found from research, for example, that if you have a chemical attack, that for every casualty, you could expect 8 sympathetic casualties, meaning that they perceive they have some kind of symptom They suspect they may have been exposed, but they actually haven't and may not even have a reason to believe that. So when you look at planning, you say this hospital can respond to 400 victims, for example, but what people don't understand is they're actually going to have to respond to 3,200 victims because there are going to be 8 sympathetic casualties for every 1 actual casualty. So we started looking at information like that, saying, how can we give this information to the people who make these decisions so they can better resolve the crisis? And when I talk about information management, that's the type of information I'm talking about. Not specifically where are the bad guys and what are they going to do next, but how are the decisions you as a command element person make, you as a commander in the situation, how are those decisions going to affect people outside the investigation? If we have a bomb scare in Times Square, for example, and you have a hockey game in Madison Square Garden, how can you cancel the hockey game or evacuate the hockey game without creating a panic and still prevent 30,000 people from coming inside the bomb radius? There are many, many different types of factors that people hadn't looked at before that could prevent calamity that were not actually part of the criminal investigation. So that's what we were really pioneering here in the last year and a half, 2 years.
The FAA is considering allowing pilots to carry guns, airline pilots. And a lot of pilots seem to want that ability now. FBI agents are required to carry guns on domestic flights. What do you think of the idea of pilots flying with guns?
You look at security issues. I think definitely we have to harden the cockpits. That's a very simple fix and something that has to be done right away. Maybe the Marshals program, we have other people on planes, might be very effective. But when I'm flying on an airplane, I want the pilot to be flying the plane, not working with a handgun trying to get in a shootout. It's a very close space in a cockpit. And it's a very, very difficult issue. So anytime you take a firearm on a plane, and you have to be very, very cognizant of the downside. And anytime you fire a handgun on a plane, you're really risking a great deal of trouble. So I think sky marshals and people who have training on aircraft have a much better sense of how to deal with the situation. And if we are going to go that route, we have to go with training, lots of it. On the surface, it sounds like it makes perfect sense. These are some extraordinarily capable people, and certainly they'd be capable with a firearm. But it's a very tough issue when you think about how the thing is actually going to play out in reality. Things that sound good on paper actually don't always work out that way in reality. And I'm still working on that one, to be honest with you.
Have you ever needed to use your gun on a flight?
No, I never have. I've never been on a flight when we had any kind of trouble whatsoever. A friend of mine flew international and had someone that ended up being a real problem, but he's a big guy, and he and a couple of the passengers actually subdued the person, handcuffed the person, and then when they landed, the person was arrested. But I should say, Terry, that I flew back from London just the night before the World Trade Center bombings, and I sat not far behind the cabin in a 747 flying from London. And the door was open most of the time, and they allowed people to go into the cabin regularly. And someone actually sat right behind the pilot in a jump seat when they landed. And I was really appalled at that. That is a very basic, simple thing that we need to eliminate. Everything else is a step in the right direction. But the old policies really had some gaping holes. And fortunately, we're moving away from those.
Well, Christopher Whitcomb, thank you very much. I wish you good luck in your life as a retired FBI agent and as a writer. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Christopher Whitcomb is the author of the new memoir, Cold Zero, Inside the FBI Hostage Rescue Team. This is Fresh Air.